Crispin, the Cross of Lead, Chapters 26 through 30. Chapter 26. He began by instructing me about the pipe's holes, the stops he called them, and the way to shape my mouth around the blowing end, how to shift my fingers, how to make different sounds. Reluctantly, I took up the recorder and with fingers like soft clay tried to play. What came out were sorry, shallow squeaks. "You see," I said, "I can't do it." I offered him back the pipe. Refusing, he railed at the top of his voice, threatening to inflict upon me every kind of grisly torture if I didn't try. At first, his shouted warnings terrified me. But as the day wore on, I realized he was mostly bluster. While I didn't doubt he could have done the ghastly acts he threatened, it was but a rough kindness. The more I realized this, the more tense I became. Gradually, I found my way with tongue, fingers, and breath. Before the day was half done, I managed to pipe out his simple song. "There, you've done it," he cried out when first I did. "Now tell me you didn't hear it, too." No one was more amazed than me. To think that I, with my breath, could make a song thrilled me deeply. I wanted to play it over and over again. Bear only made me work harder. Then as I played, he began to strike his drum so as to keep the proper beats. It was mid-afternoon and I was playing when something different happened. Before my astonished eyes, this enormous man jumped up and began to dance. Holding his large hands up, pumping his knees high, prancing, his great red beard flapping, his two-pointed hat bobbing this way and that, the hat bells jingling, he was like one possessed. Though a giant, he appeared as light as a goose feather in a swelling breeze. I was so taken aback at the sight, I stopped playing. "Now you know why I took you on," he said with a grin. It took a moment for me to fully grasp his meaning. He wanted me to help him. Please stop here and answer question one. "Play, fool," he yelled. "That's the point of it all." Excited, I resumed, continuing to make music while he paused to scoop up his leather balls. For now, as he danced, he also juggled. Then, to all of this, he added singing. "Lady Fortune is friend and foe. Of poor she makes rich, and rich of poor also. Turn misery to prosperity and wellness unto woe. So let no man trust this lady who turns her wheel ever so." Finally, he stopped. Panting, he thumped me on the back and said, "There, Crispin, my young and foolish soulless saint. You see what we shall do? While I perform my revels, you shall pipe the tune. I promise it shall bring us pennies of plenty, and we, the bear and his cub, shall prosper greatly." His words made me grin. At this, Bear thrust his hand aloft. "Oh God," he cried, "look upon thy miraculous gift. This wretched boy has given the world a smile." That night, as we made ready to sleep, Bear informed me that on the following day we would reach a village by the name of Burley. "It's only 2 leagues from where we are. An easy walk," he said, "and on the main road to Great Wexley." Bear's news about the morrow made me very nervous. Since I had left Stromford, the only person I had been with was him. But I said nothing. He would, I fear, only mock my worries. Instead, when Bear was asleep, I went upon my knees and with my lead cross in hands prayed. "Blessed St. Giles," I whispered to the cross, "let me play the music well. Let me be a credit to my master, and I beg thee, let me have a soul, that I too may sing and dance like Bear. And St. Giles, do not let him betray me." Please stop here and answer question two. Chapter 27. Next morning we set off at dawn and soon were trudging along the dirt road. At that place it meandered among low hills so that we never had a clear view of very far. Only through the tree breaks did we catch glimpses of open fields. We had been going a little while when Bear abruptly halted. "What's the matter?" I said. "Look," he said, pointing to the sky. I saw nothing but a flock of wood pigeons swirling high above some ways beyond where we were. "The pigeons?" I said. "They're agitated by something." "What?" "We'd best find out," he said. "Stay close." Straight away he lopped off the road and I followed. He led me into a small spiny ample enough to hide us from view. Once there he spied out. Without speaking, he pointed toward a hill some ways across the nearest field. When I nodded my understanding, he ran toward it. I kept close. Upon reaching the base of the hill, he dropped upon his hands and knees, motioning that I should leave the sack behind. He began to crawl toward the hill crest. When he reached it, he pulled off his cap and lifted his head just above the summit. After gazing a while, he turned slightly, beckoned me closer, and whispered, "Look, but be careful not to show yourself." Cautiously, I raised my head. What I saw before me was the road we'd been traveling on, but somewhat farther along. At a place that had been hidden from our view was a small plank bridge spanning a river. Some 12 men were loitering about. A few were sitting on the ground. Others stood by the bridge. All were armed with swords and longbows. It was as if they were waiting for someone. Among them was one I recognized. "Bear!" I whispered, my heart pounding. "It's John Eacliffe, the steward of Stromford Village!" Bear looked at me, but in a different way than he had before, then at the men again. After a few more moments, he edged back. Pulling at my arm, he bade me follow. We went partway down the hill to a place where we would not be seen. Once there, he sat in silence while I waited anxiously for him to tell me what to do. "Crispin," he said with the utmost solemnity, "mortal men are never perfect. In my life, I've done things I'm ashamed of, things that the all-seeing God shall see emblazoned on my soul. You said they proclaimed you a wolf's head because you stole. You deny you are a thief. It's not for me to punish you. God awaits. But I must know the absolute truth. By all that's sacred, did or did you not do what they say you did?" The way he spoke distressed me. Even so, I only said, "No." He sighed and shook his head. "I believe you, but it makes no sense. They should be glad you fled. At best, you're a nuisance. Why are they searching so hard for you?" he wondered out loud. "And why should they think, or care, that you're heading for Great Wexley?" Please stop here and answer question 30. "How do they even know?" "This is the only road," he explained. "Have you anything to say to this?" "I told you they were after me." "You were right. I should have listened more. But Crispin, there must be something more here, more than you know." Whatever satisfaction I had in hearing him admit that I was right paled when I saw his alarm. "What are we going to do?" I said. "We'll go no farther along this road," he said. "That's certain. But I must go forward. We'd better strike across there," he said, pointing beyond the field towards some outlying woods. "It'll take us away from those men and your steward." Without further ado, he rose and marched off with great strides. I rushed to keep up, more than once looking back. As we went along, I kept thinking how Bear had noticed the birds, which allowed him to see the soldiers. If, I told myself, I was to stay alive in this new world, I must learn such skills as he had. The sooner I learned, I told myself, the longer my life. Please stop here and answer question 4. Chapter 28. For the rest of the day, we made our way without the benefit of roads. A few times we came upon narrow paths, and these we followed, but only for short times. Instead, Bear went this way, now that, following no reason that I could grasp, other than that we moved farther and farther from the steward. As we went, he hardly spoke. "Do you know where we're going?" I finally said.
"To where you can remain alive," he replied.
It was dusk when he finally allowed us to stop. Rain had begun to fall. The dismal drizzle caused the overhanging leaves to drip with irritating monotony. Before a low and flaring fire which sputtered in the damp, we ate two small pigeons Bear had managed to snare. Perhaps to shift my mind from my worries, he showed me how he did this snaring, using a few long strands of horsetail hair that he kept in his bag. After tying the strands together, he made them into a loop, which enabled him to trap, with great cunning, the birds without even knowing that they were in danger. I was much engaged. After eating, we stayed on opposite sides of the fire, taking what warmth we could. Bear was in a solemn mood and spoke very little, seemingly preoccupied with his own thoughts. "Do you believe me now?" I said.
"About what?"
"That they are looking for me."
"Yes," he said.
I lay back and recalled what had happened in the forest at Stromford. "Bear," I said, sitting up, "I remembered something else."
"What?"
"The man the steward had met had a horse, a fine one. He must have been a man of wealth."
Bear only shrugged.
Then I said,
I wish I knew what the document was that the stranger brought to John Aycliffe, though even if I had seen it, I couldn't have read it. By and by, I'll teach you, he said. Please stop here and answer question 5. There? Yes, lad, he said sleepily. I've remembered something else. Before I left, the priest told me my mother could read and write. How could such a miserable peasant woman acquire such skills? I don't know. I never saw her do so, but Father Quinnell insisted it was true. Did he teach her? He didn't say, but he insisted it was she who wrote on my cross. Bear rubbed his face and beard, then rolled back down onto his back. Enough, he said. We'd best sleep. If we intend to survive, we'll need to find a village soon. As usual, before I lay down, I fetched the cross from the pouch from around my neck and placed it between my hands when I, upon my knees, began to pray. Crispin, I heard Bear cry out. I looked around. Give me that cross. Remembering what he had said about crosses and concerned that he might do it some harm, I said, I'd rather not. Give it, he roared. It's precious to me, I said, holding it back. By God's honest heart, he said, I won't do it any harm. Do you truly vow? By the bloody hands of Christ, he said. Though reluctant, I gave him what he wanted. Taking the cross in his great hands, where it seemed even smaller than it was, he peered at it with his shrewd eyes, even feeling it with his fingers. Next, he brought it near to the fire. Knowing that lead could melt in fire, I cried, Don't cast it away! Paying me no mind, he held the cross in his palm in such a way that it was illuminated by our little light fire, while he squinted at it closely. I realized then that he was looking at the words. Can you read what it says? I asked. He did not reply. Instead, he handed the cross back to me. The light is too weak, he said, and I need my sleep. With that, he rolled onto his back again and closed his eyes. I looked at him. And at the cross, certain he'd found a meaning that he was not prepared to tell. Please stop here and answer question 6. Chapter 29. In the morning, Bear was much subdued. Now and again, as we prepared to go, I caught him glancing at me when he thought I would not notice. He said nothing, however, and I decided not to ask. I knew him well enough by then to know that he'd speak only when he chose. We set off over hills and through woods until at last we came upon a narrow winding path. Here, Bear paused. We'll go this way, he announced. It will lead us somewhere. Sure enough, by mid-morning, we heard the distant tolling of a bell. We stopped. There must be a village or a league or so ahead, Bear cautioned. Can you remember everything I told you about how we should enter such a place? I think so. Try your tunes, he said. I took out the recorder and played. He listened intently. Good, he said. You've learned well enough. We'll prosper as long as you do as I've taught you. Where for him, he seemed nervous. What's the matter? I asked. Crispin, he said solemnly. If there is any trouble, ever, you're not to pay any mind to me. Just run. Run? I said, taken aback. From what? If anyone should try to harm or apprehend you. But where would I go? He thought for a moment. As far north as you can go. Why there? You'll be safest out of the kingdom. But aren't we going to Great Wexley? We are. On the 23rd of June, the eve of the feast of St. John the Baptist. Why then? I asked. It's Midsummer Day. The city will be crowded with a large market and festivities. That's always good for mummers. We should do well. And, as I told you, I have some matters with a man. What man? He ruffled his beard. It's a private matter. Then he added, as if to mollify me, I've promised to be there, and so I must. He was being evasive again, as when I'd asked him about the writing on my cross. There's more, isn't there? Crispin. I'm part of a brotherhood. It's to make things better, to bring some change.
Nothing really changes, I said, thinking he had misspoken. He looked at me with a smile.
Have you not changed?
A little, I admitted.
Crispin, I merely wish to bring some of that freedom you seek.
He studied the sky as if some answer might be there, but I fear the time isn't ready.
Please stop here and answer question 7.
You expect some hazard, don't you? Though I knew he heard my question, he acted as if he hasn't. Is there some danger there for me? I pressed.
By St. Pancras, he said, I was surprised when we saw that gathering waiting for you at the bridge.
That's for me. What about you?
He shrugged. I never fear for myself.
Why?
I make my own choices.
Then do you fear for me there?
Perhaps.
Why?
Crispin, when it comes to the affairs of men, I only worry about what I cannot understand.
And? I can't make sense of your innocence. In a ruthless world, I find innocence more a puzzle than evil.
We must go there then?
Crispin, I told you, I promised this brotherhood that in my travels I'd survey the kingdom, that I would bring them the judgment of my observations. I try to keep my word. They're waiting for me.
He picked up some dirt and rubbed it between his hands.
I must give them the benefit of my judgment. That's all.
You read the writing on my cross, I said. What did it say?
He offered up a wry smile. Crispin, if we wish to survive, it's time for us to go to work.
There!
Enough, he said with sudden authority and turned away.
Please stop here and answer question 8.
Chapter 30.
It was not long before we approached the wooded outskirts of a little village. Its name was Lodgecott, as we would later learn. When we came out from the trees, we saw cultivated fields. Men, women, and children were hard at work, just as at Stromford, plowing, weeding, and hoeing. The clothes they wore could have come right from my home, too. Here and there, sheep and cattle grazed. I found it a marvel that I could see so much of the world, yet find it much the same. As we passed the fields, people paused in their work to look at us. At first, Bear ignored them. Only when we drew closer to the village itself did he pause and scrutinize what lay ahead.
I don't see any signs of trouble, he said.
I looked around.
What kind of trouble? I asked.
The people looking for you. Now play. Though nervous, I put the pipe to my mouth and began to make music. Even as I did, Bear began his dance. So it was that we entered the village.
If the village of Lodgecott had been exchanged with Stromford, I don't think the world would have noticed. It contained the same cluster of small dwellings along a single rough road with but one or two structures larger than the rest. Every house was roofed with thatch and the walls of wattle and dowel. A stone church with a stubby tower stood close to the village center. On a low hill not far away, I spied a manor house. It was larger than the other houses, but not by very much. As we came into the village proper, dogs, pigs, and children approached us with a snuffling curiosity. They made sure to keep their distance. It was harder to say who was dirtier, the children or the beasts. Women emerged from cottages to stare at us guardedly, keeping their younger children behind their skirts. One of these women had a whispered exchange with a child who promptly raced off toward the church. Remembering what I'd been told, I, still playing music, headed straight for the church too. Even as we approached it, a priest emerged, no doubt alerted by the child. He was a younger man than Father Quinnell, short, thin, with large round eyes and a stubble of an ill-shaved beard. He did not appear very clean. His robes were quite soiled. Frowning, he stood before the church doors, hands clasped before him. I stepped aside and let Bear approach. He danced right up to where the priest stood and then, to my astonishment, halted and sank to his knees, pulling off his cap. I stopped playing and hoped my unease did not show.
"Most Reverend Father," Bear said in a voice loud enough so all onlookers might hear, "I, known as the Bear, am a juggler. My son and I have made our way from the city of York going toward Canterbury to perform sacred penance. We do humbly beseech your blessing.
The priest visibly softened.
My boy and I beg your gracious permission to perform some simple songs and dances for the greater glory of God, for this village, and for His Grace, King Edward, England's warrior king, with whom I had the honor of fighting on the victorious fields of France.
Then Bear bowed his head, but tilted it somewhat sideways so as to keep an eye on me. I think he even winked. The priest looked at Bear, then at me, then at Bear again.
Do you know sacred songs?
I do, said Bear. Hands clapped together in prayer, he began to sing.
Mary, maiden, gracious and free, vessel of the Trinity, whose graciously listens unto me as I greet thee with my song. Through my feet unclean be, and my hopes remain unborn. Thou art the queen of paradise, of heaven, of earth, and all that is. Thou gavest birth to the king of bliss, without a sin nor sore, putting to rights all who are poor, winning life for us evermore.
At the conclusion of his song, Bear bowed his head, crossed himself, and clasped his hands over his chest, the image of humility. The priest was clearly pleased. Smiling, he raised his hands over Bear's head and pronounced a blessing. Please stop here and answer question 9. At this, Bear jumped up and nodded to me. I took it to be a signal to resume my playing, which I did with gusto. It was not long before most of the townspeople had gathered around us in a great circle. Off to one side, I played the music while Bear performed in the center. Midway through his dance, he gathered up his leather balls and began to juggle. I could hear oohs and ahs from the crowd as Bear added first a third ball, then a fourth. Then, when he stepped forward and snatched a mazer from the hands of one of the onlookers and added to the revolving mix, there was laughter and applause. The young man from whom he'd taken the mazer was a small, one-eyed youth. He wore a patch over his other eye. He also had a thin, scraggly beard that seemed designed to proclaim him older than he was. Though others roared at Bear's antics, the young man took offense at Bear's gambols and, with growing anger, made three attempts to snatch his mazer back. Each time, Bear, with greater dexterity, seemed to offer him the mazer, but at the last moment tossed it high. This was done to the great hilarity of the crowd, but to the increasing resentment of the young man. Finally, muttering curses under his breath, the young man stormed away. No one seemed to care. Attentive to what I'd been taught, I approached Bear. Still dancing and juggling, he inclined his head to allow me to remove his cap. I took it. Holding it before me, I moved about, saying nothing but begging for coins. To my great delight, we received a few pennies, as well as some bread. When Bear was finally done and stood all in a sweat, people gathered around him, even as children surrounded me and pelted me with questions. What's your name? Where are you from? Where are you going? How did you learn such things? Is your father the biggest man in the world? Were among the questions I was asked. I started to respond honestly, but caught myself and gave another name, another place. As for Bear, remembering what he had said, I claimed him for my father. At length, Bear called me to his side. Led by the priest, who was nothing but smiles now, we entered the church. Many from the village followed us inside. One of them, I noticed, was the one-eyed young man who had returned. He gazed at Bear with such malevolence, I thought he must offer harm. The church was like my own at Stromford, though with different imagery on the walls. In particular, there was a vision of Jesus harrowing hell, the demons, frightening to behold. Before the altar, both Bear and I knelt, and I, at last, prayed.
And where will you be going next? The priest asked afterward.
The onlookers seemed interested in our answers, as was the priest.
To Great Wexley, for the fair of the feast of John the Baptist, Bear returned. But always toward Canterbury, he added.
There are many villages hereabout, the priest informed us, but you need to be on the alert for a notorious murderer. I had been gazing at the images of the walls. Now I turned to listen.
What do you mean? Bear said to the priest.
At a village north of here, which I'm not which shore, a boy went mad.
After robbing the manor house, he killed a priest. I hastily looked down lest I give myself away. But as I shifted, I became aware that the one-eyed young man was staring right at me. God mend all! Bear cried with horror, making the sign of the cross. Can't they find him? No one knows where he's fled, the priest said. But an official came here along with a troop of armed men. They say the youth is very dangerous. He's been declared a wolf's head. There's a 20-shilling reward for his taking dead or alive. I'm grateful for your warning, Bear said, stony-faced. We would love to earn that money. Who is your lord here? Lord Furnival, the priest replied. And though he's been gone for these 14 years, we've received word that, give thanks to God, though gravely ill, he's at last returned to England. We pray daily that he may recover and that we may see him soon. God is kind to those who love him, Bear said. How did you learn this news? He sent a courier, a man named Dubray. With many gracious words, Bear took leave of the priest. Then he mingled with the townspeople and asked them many questions about their crops, their harvests, the life they led. And though I wished desperately to speak to him, I kept away. Please stop here and answer question 10.